From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, the life and poems of Langston Hughes, we'll hear from Arnold Rampersad, who wrote a two-volume biography of Hughes and co-edited a collection of his poems, which has just come out in paperback. Also, Stephen Schiff gives his final film review. He's leaving film criticism to pursue a new career as a screenwriter. His adaptation of Lolita is scheduled to open this fall. We'll talk with him about the big change. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. The FBI has arrested a Pennsylvania man and accused him of spying for the former Soviet Union. Robert Lipka worked for the super-secret National Security Agency during the 1960s. He was arrested today at his home in Millersville, Pennsylvania, and charged with transferring classified documents to the former Soviet Union. Government police moved into a Sarajevo suburb today, the first of five Serbian districts which will be turned over to Muslim-Croat control under terms of the Dayton Peace Accord. But the streets were empty, and most of the houses were deserted. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
The new Bosnian Federation police force, comprised of Serb, Croat, and Muslim officers, rolled into the town of Vogošća just after dawn. They found mostly deserted streets and houses. Officials estimate that 80% to 90% of the Serbs who lived in the Sarajevo suburb during the war have fled. A handful of homes and stores had been set on fire by fleeing Serbs, but most buildings simply stood empty and dark, abandoned in a hurry by their residents. Some of the Serbs who remained in Vogošća came to the town's police station to watch the arrival of the Federation officers. Some said they were worried about living under the control of their former enemies, but would remain for now and see how they're treated. A Federation policeman tried to calm a small group of Serbs. "You see," he said, "we're not monsters." This is Andy Bowers in Sarajevo.
Chrysler Corporation says it will fight a National Highway Traffic Safety Administration ruling, saying some of its cars have unsafe seat belts. Chrysler attorney Lou Goldfarb says the agency's tests were flawed.
This case is also not about Chrysler trying to avoid doing a recall. Frankly, it would be a lot easier for us to recall these vehicles than to go through this proceeding. We don't really like to be in the spotlight when it comes to safety, except maybe as safety leaders, which we are.
The case involves about 91,000 1995 Chrysler Cyrus and Dodge Stratus models. Kmart has announced plans to close 15 of its discount stores near the end of May. The move would eliminate about 1,300 jobs in eight states. A drop in consumer spending plus the partial federal government shutdowns combined to put the brakes on economic growth during the final 3 months of 1995. As a result, the Commerce Department says the economy expanded at an annual rate of just 2.1% last year, the weakest performance since 1991. Economist Robert Dieterich says the economy continues to limp along.
After having a strong expansion for a sustained period, the economy is going through a slow growth phase. If you are an optimistic sort, you might call it a soft landing. If you have a pessimistic mind, you could perhaps call it a growth recession.
On Wall Street, the Dow Industrial Average is up about 1.5 points at 56.10. This is NPR News in Washington. Firefighters say they've finally been able to control some of the huge grass fires, which have burned dozens of homes and left about $10 million in damage across the North Texas prairie land. One of the worst fires has been burning near Fort Worth for the past 2 days. Officials say it's now about 70% contained. And a fire which cut a 30-mile path of destruction across the Oklahoma-Kansas border is also under control. President Clinton is scheduled to meet with Japan's prime minister today in Los Angeles. NPR's Mandalit Del Barco reports.
The White House is billing this as a get-acquainted visit between President Clinton and Japan's new Prime Minister Ryutaro Hashimoto, who is crossing the Pacific for the one-hour meeting in a Santa Monica hotel. They're expected to touch on several of the bilateral issues to be addressed in an upcoming summit in Japan. A White House spokesman says that could include discussions on bilateral security issues, economic and trade issues, as well as broader regional issues. The tensions between China and Taiwan, the U.S. military presence in Okinawa, food assistance in flood and famine-devastated North Korea. Hashimoto, who in the past has taken a hard-line stand in trade talks with the U.S., says U.S.-Japan relations are the cornerstone to peace in the Pacific. I'm Andali Del Barco in Los Angeles.
Hundreds of high school students walked out of classes today in Salt Lake City. They were protesting the city school board's decision to ban all extracurricular activities rather than sanction a homosexual club. During the march to the state capitol, a 14-year-old girl was run over by a car and critically hurt. The World Health Organization says the government of Gabon's quick action may have headed off a mass epidemic of the deadly Ebola virus. No new cases or deaths have been reported in the West African nation in the past 4 days. I'm Anne Bozell, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Langston Hughes is generally acknowledged as the most prominent and most popular African-American poet of the century. He was also the first African-American writer who was able to support himself throughout his life by writing. Hughes championed racial consciousness as a source of inspiration for black artists. Hughes died in 1967 at the age of 65. A volume of his collected poems has just been published in paperback. It was co-edited by his biographer, Arnold Rampersad. I spoke with Rampersad in 1988, following the publication of his acclaimed biography of Langston Hughes. Rampersad is a professor of literature and director of the African American Studies program at Princeton. Let's start things off with a recording of Langston Hughes reading his poem Weary Blues, which was inspired by a blues song he heard as a child. The poem was written in 1925, and it was the first of his poems to win an award. It was granted the first prize in a literary contest conducted by Opportunity Magazine in New York City.
Droning a drowsy, syncopated tune, rocking back and forth to a mellow croon, I heard a Negro play. Down on Lenox Avenue the other night, by the pale, dull pallor of an old gas light, he did a lazy sway, he did a lazy sway, to the tune of those weary blues. With his ebony hands on each ivory key, he made that poor piano moan with melody, oh blues. Swaying to and fro on his rickety stool, he played that sad, raggy tune like a musical fool, sweet blues. Coming from a black man's soul, oh blues. In a deep song voice with a melancholy tone, I heard that Negro sing, that old piano moan. Ain't got nobody in all this world, ain't got nobody but myself. I's gwine to quit my frownin' and put my troubles on the shelf. Thump, thump, thump went his foot on the floor. He played a few chords, then he sang some more. I got the weary blues and I can't be satisfied. Got the weary blues and can't be satisfied. I ain't happy no more, and I wish that I had died. Far into the night he crooned that tune. The stars went out and so did the moon. The singer stopped playing and went to bed while the weary blues echoed through his head. He slept like a rock or a man that's dead.
Langston Hughes reading his poem Weary Blues. Arnold Rampersad told me why Hughes wrote so many poems in a blues style.
The blues best represented the spirit of black Americans. In other words, it was based in a sense of adversity, in a sense of suffering and tragedy, but it was converted through laughter and through the art of music. It was converted into something that was positive. It was a motion, in other words, from oppression to a kind of victory, always with laughter somewhere in the vicinity. And he thought that that amounted almost to a philosophy, if you like, of black life, and also a philosophy that that other peoples could turn to as they dealt with experience.
But his blues-inspired poems were criticized by both black and white critics. What kinds of criticisms did he get for these poems?
Well, his second book of poems, Fine Clothes to the Jew, which is very heavily a blues collection, I mean, that was absolutely savaged by the black critics. I think that they resented the fact that Hughes, in using dialect and in talking about people fighting with one another or prostitution and so on, urban malaise, despair, whatever, that he was showing the bad side of the race to white people. But more informed critics, both black and white, recognized that something really significant was being done. An important Chicago critic, later a major professor of American studies, Howard Mumford Jones, pointed out that in using the blues, Hughes really was doing an extraordinary thing. He was adding a form to English poetry, like the sonnet or the ballad form. And I think that's absolutely true. And a number of poets since the 20s down to our day, both black and white, have continued to write blues poetry.
I'd like to ask you to read Hughes' very first published poem, The Negro Speaks of Rivers.
This poem was published in 1921 in The Crisis, edited by W.B. Du Bois. The Negro Speaks of Rivers. I've known rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo, and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like rivers.
Is that a poem that you especially like?
I do. I like it a great deal. It comes out of a particular moment in Hughes's life. He was going off to Mexico to join his father. His father hated the idea that his son wanted to become a poet. His father, who was black, did not like black Americans, didn't like white Americans because of the way they treated him, wanted Langston Hughes to exile himself and go after money. Hughes said that he was crossing the Mississippi in a train on the way to Mexico. He looked at the sunset, the river, and it came to him suddenly that he was a part of a noble people, no matter how much they had been oppressed, what degree of poverty so many of them existed in. And this phrase came to him: "I've known rivers. We are historical. We have depth. We have spirituality." And the poem wrote itself, according to him. We don't know if it's true, but all the evidence shows that in fact it came out of that particular moment. And it's very interesting that a poem written at 19 years of age, just about, remained, in a way, his benchmark poem. I mean, I'm sure he was being asked to read it in the very last year of his life.
You got at something that's a real paradox of Langston Hughes' early life. You mentioned that his father really disliked American blacks, and Langston Hughes really disliked his father for that.
Yes.
He didn't see his father very much when he was growing up.
No, he did not.
But also when Langston Hughes was growing up, he wasn't always exposed to that many blacks. In his high school, he was one of few blacks.
That's true. In his high school, in the school before that, where he wrote his first poem in the little town of Lincoln in Illinois, and before that in Lawrence, Kansas, where he grew up. He was very often the only, or perhaps one of two or three blacks.
Yet he wrote so many poems celebrating the black experience. Do you think that being not among that many blacks during part of his childhood made him more aware of his blackness?
Absolutely, I think. Mm-hmm. I think he was exposed to black culture, say, in the churches, and in one or two people who were very kind to him. And I think he early on identified the regard, the loving regard of black people, as something that meant a tremendous amount to him. I don't think anything meant more to him than that. But you're right. I mean, he going on to Columbia University, he certainly did not meet any large number of blacks there. And I think he was empowered by that, the fact that he was viewing the culture to some extent inside, to a large extent from outside, made him really devoted to it.
It was in Harlem that he felt he really found his home. What brought him there?
Well, his father wanted him to go to Switzerland and study three languages and learn mining because his father owned mines in Mexico. Langston told the father he could do the same thing at Columbia, but he really wanted to go to Harlem because in 1921, Shuffle Along, with a musical, historic musical, had just opened. People were beginning to sense that the phenomenon known as the Harlem Renaissance was on its way. Exciting things were happening in that part of the world, and he wanted to be a part of that, where the Crisis magazine, Du Bois, was James Weldon Johnson, Jesse Fawcett, any number of people were there, young Paul Robeson later on. He wanted to be a part of that, so he went off to Harlem and fell in love with it. I mean, he wandered around the world a great deal, but 1947, when he finally got a little bit of money from a musical play, he bought a house and stayed there for the next 20 years of his life.
Would you read us one of his poems about Harlem?
This is a little poem from the 20s. It's called Aesthete in Harlem. Strange that in this nigger place I should meet life face to face, when for years I had been seeking life in places gentler speaking, until I came to this vile street and found life stepping on my feet.
My guest is Langston Hughes biographer Arnold Rampersad. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring an interview from the archives with Arnold Rampersad, recorded in 1988, after the publication of his biography of Langston Hughes. Rampersad co-edited a collection of Hughes' poems, which has just come out in paperback. Let's hear a 1958 recording of Langston Hughes reading his poetry with jazz accompaniment. The poem is Note on Commercial Theater. The musicians include Red Allen, trumpet, Vic Dickinson, trombone, Sam Taylor, tenor saxophone, and Milt Hinton, bass.
You've taken my blues and gone. You sing them on Broadway and you sing them in Hollywood Bowl. You mixed them up with symphonies and you fixed them so they don't sound like me. Yep, you've done taken my blues and gone. You also took my spirituals and gone. You put me in Macbeth and Carmen Jones and all kind of swing Mikados. And in everything but what's about me. But someday somebody'll stand up and talk about me, and write about me, black and beautiful, and sing about me, and put on plays about me. I reckon it'll be me myself. Yes, it'll be me.
When Langston Hughes is saying, you've taken my blues and gone, is he meaning literally himself or the work of blacks in general? And I ask that, no, knowing that he worked on the commercial theater and wasn't usually all that satisfied with the results.
No, he wasn't really talking about himself so much as the way in which so many aspects of American entertainment have taken parts of black culture, left the blacks behind if they could. I'm talking now historically. Converted jazz into sort of a hybrid musical form that would appeal across the board to people who themselves would not really want to have anything to do with the originators of the music, the black musicians. He's talking about that, and he's hoping that one day Blacks will be able to speak with their own true voices, that blacks will write their own literature and not simply have to read about themselves refracted through the eyes of white authors or white musicians. That poem was written in the 1940s, and perhaps the time has come.
I was very interested in your chronicling of his reactions to the black literature of the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and the reactions of black poets and novelists to Langston Hughes's work as Hughes got older.
Yes.
For instance, he didn't like Native Son. He thought the story was too sordid and that
right.
Blacks needed heroes.
Yes. He felt it was the wrong time. In 1940, World War II had started, if not for the United States, for the rest of the world. But I think any time he would have found the realism, the ultra-realism of Native Son, just the depiction of its black hero as essentially a brute, that was just too much for Langston Hughes, who believed that the beauty of the people should also be pointed out. And that book, I think, does not give two sides. I respect the book profoundly, but he's right in that the book does not even suggest a possibility of a richer, more humane side to black culture. And he found the same fault with a number of later books by black writers.
In the 1960s, when there were more radical definitions of blackness and when a lot of black writers were becoming more militant in their writing, many of them really parted with Langston Hughes. He didn't necessarily like their work, and they didn't necessarily respect his accomplishments. Let me quote something that you quote, that Amiri Baraka, who is still going by the name of Leroy Jones, said in 1965. He said, "Let Langston and his ilk keep silent in the face of real artists. Theater in 1965 is not for leftover Lazaruses of the so-called Negro Renaissance."
Well, that's particularly interesting, since in the 50s, when Leroy Jones was living in the Village and Greenwich Village, and performing as an editor, sometimes as the only black, usually as the only black in a sea of white poetic voices, Langston often pressed him to take race more into account. I mean, he liked and admired Leroy Jones. He thought he was enormously talented, but he kept telling him, "You have got to look at your own people and what we have done and listen to the blues and the jazz and so on." 5 years later, 6 or 7 years later, Leroy Jones has swept past Langston Hughes, but of course, we know that he has also returned in recent years back to a position much closer to Langston Hughes than he was in 1965 or 66. And he now speaks with great reverence for Langston Hughes, if only because he discovered later on that many of the positions he took subsequent to that nationalist episode were positions anticipated by Langston Hughes maybe 30 years ago. So he is among the most fervent praisers of Langston Hughes today.
You raise the question of Langston Hughes' sexuality in your book. Some people thought he was homosexual, in part because he never married and also because he frequently hung around with young, attractive men. But you suggest he was probably asexual and that there's really no evidence that he partook of many heterosexual relationships or any homosexual relationships.
Right. I encountered the rumors fairly early on, and also the beliefs that this man was homosexual. I think the sexuality of a poet, of a writer, is very important for a biographer.
Why? Because some people would think, well, that's really none of the public's business. Why are you bringing that up?
Well, I think that biography is the story of the life, and sexuality is obviously important to the life. It may not be so important to the art, and I think it's not very easy to tell from Langston Hughes's poetry his sexual persuasion. But I think the biographer really is interested in every aspect, even those that's important, even if it's not related to the art. If, for example, Langston Hughes had run for office and for some particular office that had nothing to do with poetry, it would still be important to a biographer. I tracked down this aspect of his life as best I could, as diligently as I could. I was certainly prepared to reveal anything I found that would be definitive or persuasive. Found nothing. The true story is that the man seemed to hide his sexual activity to such an extent that you have to wonder how much of it there was and why he was so determined not to let people know what he was doing in this regard. He created created a family for himself toward the end of his life, but it was a family in which he, as a 40-something, 50-something, and then 60-something-year-old man, was essentially a son, because he was living with a man and woman he called aunt and uncle, who were not really related to him, but who had known him virtually all his life. So he believed in family life, that's for sure. He believed in young people. He clearly, in the 50s and 60s, saw some young men as his sons and tried to help them. But as far as I know, that was the extent to which it went.
Let me ask you to read one more Langston Hughes poem. Would you read Dream Variation?
Dream Variation is a poem that written again in his youth, about 1924, I would think. Dream Variation. To fling my arms wide in some place of the sun, to whirl and to dance till the white day is done, then rest at cool evening beneath a tall tree, while night comes on gently, dark like me. That is my dream. To fling my arms wide in the face of the sun, dance, whirl, whirl, till the quick day is done. Rest at pale evening, a tall, slim tree, night coming tenderly, black like me.
When Langston Hughes died at the age of 65 in 1967, do you think that he felt that his writing had been appreciated?
I think he did. The previous year he had been to, I always forget the exact name of this gathering, but it was a gathering of Pan-African peoples, artists of the world in Dakar, put on by Léopold Sédar Senghor, the poet president of Senegal. And you had people from all over the world, blacks and whites, and he clearly was regarded as one of the founding fathers of the idea of negritude, or of soul, if you like, in a literary and artistic sense. The New York Times talked about how young writers followed him about the way in the United States youngsters would follow a baseball star about. So he knew he had left his mark on world culture, particularly where black people were concerned. Whether he felt he'd got exactly his justice, I don't know, but he was to some extent a fatalistic person. So I'm pretty certain that he believed at the end that that he had done well. He had done well, that he had lived up to the charge that his grandmother must have left him, and that was that he had to do something for the world, something that was noble, something that was good, worthwhile for the world. And he had done so.
You only have a few seconds left, but let me ask you. You must have asked yourself what Langston Hughes would have thought of your two-volume biography had he been able to read it.
I think he would have chuckled. I think he would have laughed. At his funeral, he requested that, in planning for it, requested that the last tune be a tune that Duke Ellington made famous called Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me. And I think he would have believed that somehow he had reached across from the grave. He had an offbeat sense of humor, and he would have been amused at some of the mistakes in the book, too, because, of course, there must be mistakes, since no biographer can possibly recover the truth either about the facts or even the spirit of the person, not 100% truth. So somewhere I think he is laughing at the effort, but I hope he's also glad that I wrote the book.
I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Arnold Rampersad, recorded in 1988 after the publication of the second volume of his biography of Langston Hughes. Rampersad co-edited a collection of Hughes' poems, which has just come out in paperback. Rampersad is director of the African American Studies Program at Princeton and is now at work on a biography of Jackie Robinson. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Stephen Schiff reviews the new film Before and After. And then I'll tell us why this is going to be his final film review. He's giving up writing about movies so he can write screenplays. His adaptation of Lolita is scheduled to open this fall. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Director Barbe Schroeder has become well-established in Hollywood with films like Reversal of Fortune, Single White Female, and last year's Kiss of Death. Before that, he had another career as the producer of some of the finest European films of the 70s, including Eric Rohmer's My Night at Maud's and Wim Wenders' The American Friend. He was also the director of such provocative features and documentaries as Idi Amin Dada, Moore, and La Maîtresse. His latest movie is adapted from a 1992 novel by Rose Ellen Brown. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of Before and After.
In the Hollywood of the 80s and early 90s, unhappy endings were virtually forbidden. And that was an odd situation, since it meant that the dominant dramatic art form of our time, the movies, offered very little room for the dominant dramatic art form of all time, that is, tragedy. But in the last 2 years, tragedy has come sneaking home to Hollywood on tiptoe, in movies like Leaving Las Vegas, and even, in somewhat less obvious ways, in pictures like Seven, Dead Man Walking, and 12 Monkeys. A good tragedy leaves you feeling not depressed, but exalted, torn apart and put back together again. Before and After should have been like that. It sets out to be a tragedy, but you can see it getting progressively more timid as it goes along, until, by the end, it seems to have shrunk to something sickly and sweet, and, yes, a little depressing. The setup is simple. The Ryan family lives in a grand house in the invented Berkshire town of Highland, Massachusetts. Ben, played by Liam Neeson, is a successful artist. His wife, Carolyn, played by Meryl Streep, is a pediatrician. They have a teenage son and a younger daughter, and they're living the good life. But then a female classmate of their son is killed, apparently brutally murdered. And the son, Jacob, played by Edward Furlong, disappears. He turns out to be the chief suspect. And pretty soon his father is ransacking his boy's car, where he finds a bloody jack and blood-soaked towels and gloves. Acting on instinct, he destroys the evidence and then lies to the police, and suddenly this tight little family is in it up to their necks. It's time to get a good lawyer, and the Ryans find one in Panos Demeris, expertly played by Alfred Molina. But at their first meeting, Carolyn Ryan doesn't take to him at all.
I'm a physician, and there isn't much I haven't seen, but this is my son you're talking about.
You may like to remember, Dr. Ryan, it's always somebody's son or daughter.
Don't you patronize me, sir, because I can...
Hey, let's calm down. All of us, calm. This isn't getting us anywhere. Come on.
Look, I'm sorry, folks. But if you don't like me now, what are you going to say when I have to get up in front of that jury and argue that your son is not guilty by reason of diminished mental capacity? That he was drunk, stoned, bombed out of his skull on crack.
My son does not do drugs.
He may be your son, Mr. Ryan, but he would be my client, and I would not ask your permission for how I choose to defend him. I'm going to have to do whatever it takes. And if you don't like my style, wait till you hear the prosecution.
The first hour of Before and After is beautifully put together. And any parent will immediately discover the poignancy in the situation. Could your own child have done something monstrous? And if so, how much of the blame really lies with you, the parent? Moreover, what do you do for the child you love? Do you lie and destroy evidence the way Ben Ryan does? Or do you put your faith in truth and the law the way his wife does? The questions are timeless, but they get fuzzier as the movie goes along. This would have been a smarter, edgier film if the son had remained the ambiguous figure he is during the film's first half. That is, if the real mystery that all children eventually are to their parents had been maintained. Instead, the movie succumbs to what must have been the usual round of script conferences and compromises. By the end, it very nearly dissolves into mush. Fortunately, there's Neeson giving a stormy, touching performance as a father who's always taken pride in being headstrong and bold and now must face the possibility that those very traits could destroy his son. Streep has a less clearly written role, and she tends to fade in the face of Neeson's power, but as the son, Edward Furlong is a match for them both. Through his delicate stillness, he lets you see the turmoil boiling underneath. With acting like that, Before and After should have been a powerful tragedy. The way it wound up, it feels merely like pretty good TV.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. And he's embarking on a new career as a screenwriter. That means he won't be reviewing movies anymore. Stephen has been Fresh Air's film critic since we first became a daily national show in May of 1987. His reviews have always been a high point of the Fresh Air week. It's not easy to say goodbye. But we're trying to keep an upbeat attitude. How's this? We're not losing a film critic. We're gaining a gifted screenwriter. There's no way Stephen Schiff is leaving Fresh Air without first telling us what it's been like to see the movie world from his new point of view as a screenwriter. Stephen, first of all, what's the status of your first screenplay, a new version of Lolita?
Lolita just finished filming, finished the shooting process, and everyone's kind of taking a month off while the editor puts together a rough assemblage, and then it'll be edited and presumably will be released this fall.
Wow. So who's directing, who's starring?
The director's Adrian Lyne. Who made Fatal Attraction and Jacob's Ladder and a bunch of other movies. And Humbert, the lead character, is played by Jeremy Irons. Charlotte Hayes, the mother, is played by Melanie Griffith. Lolita herself is played by a newcomer named Dominique Swain, who was a 15-year-old discovery from Malibu High, had never been in a movie before except doing stunt work. And Quilty is played by Frank Langella.
Wow. Now, how did you get a crack at this?
This is a strange thing. I don't recommend my method to anyone else because it would just never happen. But if you do what I've done for many years, which is to say write about movies, you get asked a lot whether you want to write a screenplay, partly because some of the people you might be interviewing would like to just sort of buy you off. And frankly, I've never had any interest in doing it, really, because in the first place, I never thought that writing without prose would be of interest to me. And secondly, because I thought just because you can write and just because you know movies doesn't mean you can write movies. But around, I think it was 87 or 88, actually around the time we started our little relationship here on Fresh Air, some friends called me and said that the Nabokov estate was beginning to option off properties. And Swifty Lazar, I believe, had Lolita. And friends who knew me in Hollywood said, look, this would be great for you. You should write this. You'd have a screenplay. You know, you'd get a movie made. And I went, well, Lolita. Now, this is the best book I ever read. And it's, you know, this is an unusual opportunity. And I actually sat down and began to write, and it was fun, and I was extremely naive. All I did was write dialogue, and in between I wrote stage directions to come, thinking I would get to them later. Then a few weeks later, the friends called me and said, look, forget it. We gave you a bum steer. In this political environment, Lolita cannot be made, will not be made. Go back to work. Have a nice life. So I did. Time passed. I read in the trade papers and whatnot that Adrian Lyne was indeed going to make this film, and that James Dearden, who had written Fatal Attraction for him, was writing it. And a soft sigh escaped my lips, and then James Dearden went away, and Harold Pinter had been hired to write it. And I went, oh, well, so that happens. And finally, in the fall of 94, I got a call from Richard Zanuck, who was an old friend who had produced Driving Miss Daisy and Jaws and The Sting and all sorts of movies. And he said, do you have some pages there that you wrote? And I said, well, if you want to see them, I'll send them. And I did. And they got kind of excited, and we started having meetings. And meanwhile, they were hiring David Mamet to do yet another version. But I kept at it, sort of on spec, because I had a good feeling about it and because I was having the time of my life, really, writing this. And finally, I sent it in, and they loved it, and they decided to make my screenplay.
You know, you said that there's, when you're a film critic, there's always people who are inviting you to write screenplays. Why?
Well, I think sometimes they think you are living a low life of some sort and must want out. And sometimes I think they would like you to get out. And sometimes, I sort of think they're trying to buy you off.
Or to kind of like flatter you into giving them good reviews in the future or something?
There are a lot of sort of Hollywood operators who have made a practice of taking journalists and giving them, you know, jobs that sort of shut them up for many years. And the journalists kind of fade into obscurity at not great cost to the producers. And pretty soon it's a thorn out of their sides.
You know, I should think that adapting Lolita would be really difficult. I mean, Nabokov was such a brilliant and rich writer, and so much of the book is in the sentences, in just like the writing itself. So how did you deal with how much of your dialogue comes directly from Nabokov, and I'm not sure that most of it would really work in people's mouths as opposed to just on the page?
Well, you're so completely right about that, and I wish you had told that to some of the actors. This always happens when there's, apparently it always happens when there's a book sources that the actors start, if they're having a hard time with one of your lines, they start going back to the book and sort of curling their mighty mouths around what's there. The fact is that I think you're completely right. In the mouths of actors, a lot of this very curly-cued, beautiful, ornate writing that Nabokov did sounds pretentious and over the top and extremely mannered and not like the way people talk at all. And there are a lot of other things going on in Lolita, because everything in Lolita is happening really through the consciousness of this one extraordinarily brilliant but cracked person, Humbert Humbert.
Exactly.
And he's got this gorgeous intelligence that, however, is completely subject to his obsession with this nymphette, with nymphettes of every stripe, but particularly Lolita. And so everything is seen through this unreliable narrator. So what you have to do in recreating Lolita, to the degree that anyone can, is you have to indeed invent a lot of dialogue. You have to really create the character of Lolita, who is not there on the page in a way in the book, because you get a glimmer of the difference between the way he sees her and the way she really is. But on a movie screen, you have to see her. She has to live and breathe. She has to have dialogue, and it has to be really true-to-life dialogue. It can't be this kind of semi-satirical, very ornate version of a child's possible dialogue that Nabokov invented. And finally, you have to create a relationship between them, which doesn't really exist at all in the book. It's just sort of hinted at in sort of fragments of sentences. So, yeah, it was hard, but of course this was also a labor of love.
Do you consider this a remake of the Kubrick version of Lolita, or do you consider it an adaptation of the novel?
Well, I consider it an adaptation of the novel, and we didn't, none of us looked upon it as a remake in any way. In fact, I hadn't seen the Kubrick version for many years and didn't allow myself to go back to it. And frankly, I was the only one on the set who sort of had remembered thinking highly of it. We really just started from scratch from the novel. And, I went back to look at the Kubrick version not long ago, and it was very interesting how different it was from mine and how I would call the Kubrick version quilty, because the Peter Sellers character so dominates it and is so... Kubrick loved him so much that he just let him loose. And the stuff that's best in the movie is Peter Sellers' improvisations, which, of course, don't have much to do with Nabokov at all.
So does the movie industry seem really different from the point of view of screenwriter than it seemed from the point of view as critic?
Yes, it seems a lot different. A lot of critics, and I've never really been one of these, have tried to, in their minds, keep themselves very pure. Not talking to anyone on the other side of the industry, not having relationships with them, not going out to visit, not going onto movie sets to see how it's done. I think if you do that, you still have the right to judge a film for its aesthetic qualities, but very few critics practice that kind of discipline when they don't know what they're talking about. Instead, they say, well, the script is this, and this screenwriter only knows this, and the cinematographer did this, and very often they just don't know what they're talking about. And when you see what the process is, it's so collaborative. Of course, you know, film criticism has this sect called auteurist, and that gives the credit for a movie to the director. As a screenwriter, I now object more strenuously than ever. And it is so collaborative, and you can't say that it's, you know, the screenwriter is the author either, but everyone is working together in this strange way, and some people have more power at various times than others. You know, of course, the director in general has the final say-so, but the screenwriter is developing the blueprint for the house. And so in a certain way, he's the architect, and the director can sometimes be seen as the builder.
Stephen Schiff is with us. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Stephen Schiff. He's been Fresh Air's film critic for nearly 9 years. He's giving up film criticism for his new career as a screenwriter. So you're in the position now of potentially working with people or having meetings with people you've given bad reviews in the past. Is this a source of discomfort?
Yes, it has been. And that of course, is the reason why I have to resign from this position that I've enjoyed so much for so many years, is that... you know, I'm used to being able to say whatever I want. That is the one strange prerogative that a journalist has almost uniquely, is that he can go anywhere and say what he wants. He can go on television and say what he wants. That's his job, so he gets to. And if he makes people angry, well, that's part of the consequence, and he hopes that there are understanding people, and sometimes there are and sometimes there aren't. In Hollywood, people tend to be thin-skinned, and they tend to, in a way, consider themselves a side in an argument, and the film critic is on the other side in the argument. And they also, they have very little respect for the film critic. They think the film critic hasn't done it. He doesn't know how to do it. It's sort of like the, if you can, you do, and if you can't, you teach. And if you're even more abject than that, you're a critic. I beg to differ with that point of view, but that is the point of view out there. I think there's not much respect for actual in-depth aesthetic evaluation. And in many cases, of course, critics don't merit that kind of, you know, scrutiny. They are not providing something that's in-depth aesthetic evaluation. So, you know, the worst practitioners of film criticism make it hard for the rest of us out there. And yet, I think the thin skins out there are probably unnecessary and do unnecessary damage to the relationship.
Do you have you already had meetings with some people and you're thinking, I hope they don't remember the review I gave them.
Yes. Yes, I would say that's definitely true. Now, look, there are some who are more grown up and some who are less grown up about this. And I really don't think there was an occasion, and I won't go into very much detail, unfortunately, as I once would have done, when an actor turned down a part that I had written. Well, actually, the actor turned down Humbert. Which is a dangerous part for an actor to take on, it must be said. And if you're trying to maintain a certain kind of reputation as a gleaming, virtuous star, you're not going to want to be seen in this situation with this young girl. So that actor probably didn't want the part for that reason. But one of the reasons he gave was that I had given him a bad review and said something bad about him once. So that, I don't think if an actor really, really wants the part, or if a director or someone really sees this as, you know, the work that they're going to spend the next many months, even years on, that they will let my review and their resentment over it.
Now, would you work with someone whose previous work you didn't much respect?
Hard question, you know, because now that I see what goes into the process, and now that I see what kind of compromises are involved, and now that I also see how much I could do for someone. In other words, there are people whose work I might not respect, but who have everything it takes to do good work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, and maybe in certain cases, the difference between what they've done and what I consider very good work is a screenplay. I mean, there are some directors of whom I would not say that, and I would say, you know, they don't have the talent. I don't want to work with them, or their taste is so bad that we will never get along. But there are some directors that I feel that maybe I could help to make a movie that at least I would like. I'm sure that once in my life it would have been easier to make that kind of hard and fast rule, but I'm not doing it now.
So Lolita is scheduled to open in the fall. Mm-hmm. What else are you working on?
Then I did a movie called Stormy Weather, which was from Carl Hiaasen's most recent bestseller. He's the guy who wrote Striptease, which is now just about to be released, and it's the role that Demi Moore got her famous $12.5 million for. Stormy Weather I'm making for 20th Century Fox division called Fox 2000. And also the Xanax are involved in that. And Meg Ryan is involved in that and will probably be one of the stars. It's a multi-character piece that takes place in Florida after an apocalyptic hurricane. So apocalyptic that people really are behaving as they would if it were the end of the world. And it's funny.
Film critic, now screenwriter, Stephen Schiff is with us. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Stephen Schiff, he's been Fresh Air's film critic for nearly 9 years. He's giving up film criticism for his new career as a screenwriter. Stephen, you haven't written screenplays, you know, until recently.
Yeah, Lolita was the first.
Yeah, but on the other hand, you've written a lot of profile pieces over the years. And in writing profiles, you're not exactly writing dialogue, but you are quoting your interviewees a lot. Has quoting them helped you understand how dialogue works?
Well, the whole process, I mean, you're really onto something there because, you know, when you're writing a profile, what you're doing is creating a character. And you're also creating a narrative where none exists. Because, you know, a profile isn't like a news story, which I've written sort of straight narrative stories in which this happens and then this happens and this happens. A profile, you have to make it feel as though the narrative is rushing along, even though there's no story there. And so it has to be character-driven, as they say. And so you have to create a character on the page, and even in a certain sense, you have to take what is on your tape recorder and turn it into viable dialogue. Which, you know, of course, this will shock people who think that every single word that is spoken is what appears on a page. But people do when they're talking, they do what I just did. They go back, they say they say, you know, they repeat themselves, they mess up. You can't read too much of that without falling asleep. So in a way, you do have to shape dialogue, if not invent it. So all those things of kind of inventing narrative, inventing character, shaping dialogue turned out to be much more useful than I had ever expected them to be.
The review that you just did for Fresh Air is your last review, as far as we know.
Ouch.
Yeah. How do you feel about giving up film criticism?
Well, I actually am distraught in a certain way because this has been a vein through my entire writing life. And it's, you know, it's a great love of mine. And, you know, of course, movies are a great love of mine. And I'm on the making end of them, and so that's fine. And yet, this process of confronting a work, a movie, and taking it apart and seeing how it works and how it doesn't work and why, and reimagining it in a way for a listener or a reader, is just it's very close to my heart. And saying goodbye to it is painful.
Now, are you going to have to silence the critic in you as you continue to write screenplays? Do you worry that, you know, you're so busy, like, reviewing the film before it's even made that you might stifle yourself?
Well, it's funny. I had that same thought, and I thought that that would happen. And what I find really happening is that instead all that kind of critical stance may be much more helpful than I anticipated, in that it doesn't censor me. It seems so far not to censor me so much that I am paralyzed, but it does when you come to a cliché. I mean, the buzzer in my head is very, very loud, or when you come to something that doesn't work, it's very, very loud, and I just go, oh, not that. Whereas maybe, I don't know for sure, but maybe someone who hadn't gone through this critical process for so many years would go down that blind alley a little farther than I may be likely to. The other thing is that, you know, I mean, seeing movies again and again and thinking through them and running them through your head the way a film critic does when he's trying to sort of conjure up the experience again, well, maybe that helped to make it possible to, as I write scenes, I see the scenes in my head. I see the characters. I am making the movie in my head. I don't know whether there's a connection between film criticism and that, but it seems likely.
You know, usually at the end of the year, we do a year-end wrap-up, and you kind of sum up what's been happening in the movie world over the past year. And, the post-mortem at the end of each year usually is not that good. You know, you've had some pretty discouraging things to say about the state of the movie industry over the years. I don't know. How does that affect you now? Does it make you a little cautious?
That's interesting. You know, having spent more and more time out there and talked with all these people who are, you know, the sort of big guns who are making the movies, I see how it happens and I see why it happens a little more. I've always maintained that no one goes out to Hollywood with the express intent of making, you know, Friday the 14th Part 7. Everyone wants to go out and make Citizen Kane, and then you get involved in all sorts of things, the business and, you know, the bad taste of others, the caution of others, the caution of the owners of the studio compared with what you want to do. And, you know, suddenly things start shifting and turning. And frankly, this is true of the publishing industry and of the, you know, of the magazine business and of the theater and of virtually every form of sort of art/entertainment in this country, which obviously has to more and more appeal to an audience that will provide funding where sort of government funding disappears. So everyone in the arts has this question, and what I see out there is a real desire to make good movies. And sometimes they don't know what a good movie is, and sometimes they do, but run into trouble making it. At this moment in Hollywood, the actors have so much power that in a way it's the taste of the actors that is dominant, and that's a very frightening thing. And yet I see people who are extremely aware of that situation and are trying to work in such a way that with their knowledge of the way sort of actors operate, they can make the movie they want and also the movie the actors want. I think if you look at the recent Academy Awards selections, it's like a giant shrug. You know, Hollywood is saying, we don't know what we're doing and we don't know what we want. You know, we don't like what we're doing. We welcome input from an Italian/British film or from an Australian film about a talking pig. You know, let's open the doors. Let's try something different. So that may be a tortured kind of optimism, but I do feel that there is a place for optimism.
Well, Stephen, let's keep in touch, and I'm sure you'll be back on the show to talk about your movies when they open. And thank you so much for the many years of really interesting, incisive, funny, well-written reviews that you've given to us on Fresh Air. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. I'm going to miss the whole thing. I'd rather say au revoir instead of goodbye.
Okay. Well, the very first movie that Stephen Schiff reviewed for Fresh Air was Prick Up Your Ears, so we'll close with music from the soundtrack. Stephen Schiff's reviews have been produced and edited for the past 9 years by one of his biggest fans, Naomi Person, who misses him already. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.